Thanks for joining us today on WPR. Larry Mueller here, and it's a technology show for you today. Jesse LeGrew is our guest. We're going to be taking a look at the AI industry coming to Wisconsin in a big way, among other things. Jesse, of course, is a Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. He's also a volunteer handler for the SANS Internet Storm Center. We'll cover cybersecurity as well and how to use the Wisconsin Public Radio mobile app and smart speakers to listen to this show and other shows on WPR. And, of course, takes your tech questions as well as we move along today. So what questions do you have about using AI for writing and art projects? Do you worry about how safe your personal data is online? Maybe you want to set up a smart speaker to listen to WPR. Give us a call. Number's 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Jesse LeGrew, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Good to be here.
So let's start with artificial intelligence. Microsoft and artificial intelligence are certainly in the news last week. President Biden visited Racine, praised Microsoft's planned investment, $3.3 billion, I think, on an AI data center or centers here in Wisconsin. What do we know about Microsoft's plans?
Yeah, and so far, at least I think a lot of this is changing rapidly. So
yeah.
I think there was an idea of how big the data center might be and what kind of footprint was being used previously indicated to be used by Foxconn. But it sounds like those numbers are also increasing in terms of footprint and the number of individuals that would actually be trained and help to operate that data center. So it's going to be interesting to find out exactly how the center is being used and how it might be leveraged, not even just from within Wisconsin, but probably leveraged worldwide. So like most of the tools we use, it's sitting in a data center somewhere, somewhere around the world. And this is also one of many.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. The plans are there's an AI co-innovation lab at UW-Milwaukee as well. And the data center, of course, is going to be in Racine. So the labs and the data centers, basically, what would they do?
Yeah, and so the data center could be leveraged to run a variety of projects, not just for worldwide consumption, but potentially for local research or other activities. It would probably be up to kind of Microsoft and the various labs in terms of how those resources would be utilized. That's probably one of the biggest largest challenges with artificial intelligence is it tends to need a lot of power. It needs a lot of resources in order to process data and give output. Sometimes the simplest question can actually be quite resource intensive. Something similar we've actually also seen with crypto mining, which has been a large resource drain in terms of what's needed to perform those computations. So I think we're likely going to be seeing a lot probably with large language models, which is really, kind of a subtopic of machine learning, using those new resources. But it'll be interesting to find out what specifically those labs decide to research, whether it's manufacturing, more innovation with large language models. I think natural language algorithms and being able to interface with different systems as we might talk to another person in the same room is kind of interesting. So you may not need to be a programmer in order to interface with the computer to get the answer that you need. You might be able to speak it and actually get what you're looking into. I think that's going to be extremely popular as what we've seen with ChatGPT and other large language models or LLMs. It's really opened up the technology to more individuals and being able to use it in different ways. And I definitely see that being a large component of it, making that technology a little bit more accessible.
You mentioned manufacturing, and Tom Still had an interesting article in the Wisconsin State Journal yesterday about why Microsoft picked Wisconsin. And, you know, Wisconsin ranks either first or second. We switch back and forth with the state of Indiana on the percentage of its workforce engaged in manufacturing. And, you know, there's so many different manufacturing sectors here in the state: food and beverage, automotive components, medical devices, chemicals and plastics, paper products. So there are a lot of companies right here in the state that would probably be, good clients for Microsoft.
Yeah, and there's definitely a variety of aspects when thinking about manufacturing. A lot of those systems run 24/7. They generate a lot of data. A lot of that data can be processed in ways to limit downtime, which can be really significant. So if you have any kind of downtime, in many cases, 30 minutes can cost millions of dollars. So how do you minimize that time and keep that operation functioning? Being able to record and analyze that data using machine learning can be really useful. So actually being able to do predictions rather than just waiting for something to fail. While there's always that human component of sifting through and understanding the information, in a lot of ways, artificial intelligence can actually help to rise some of those items to the surface for a person to look at in a lot more depth. And then in addition to kind of keeping a manufacturing operation running, it can also be used in new ways. So natural language models and being able to have people interact with those systems in different ways and those data sets also opens a variety of possibilities, just because many people aren't experts in the technology. They might serve a variety of roles, but it might allow to ask much more informed questions to get better answers without needing to even do programming. It may need still a programmer in the background helping to prepare all those systems for a person. So I feel that's still going to be a need, but it really could make a lot of that information more accessible, not to mention, I think, some of the administrative benefits of that technology. So whether it's brainstorming, finding solutions for different things. I think one of the examples that was brought up when I was looking at some of the manufacturers in Wisconsin is having standard operating procedures and manuals that may be in binders on shelves in rooms in which people don't look into. So when something breaks, you may not be running to those binders. Maybe you do, depending on your operation. But in a lot of ways, you could actually have a custom trained LLM trained on those operating manuals to actually give responses based upon that content. So there's a lot of interesting ways to use it, really to process data for operations. There could be items for administrative troubleshooting functions, not to mention brainstorming. So there's a lot of great ways that can be a lot of great ways to use that technology. So it'll be I'm very interested, and I probably won't see firsthand. I don't work in manufacturing, but I'm sure people in that industry will find a lot of benefit, and it'll be interesting to see how it's used.
Yeah, and UW-Milwaukee is partnering with Gateway Technical College, so they say they're going to train 1,000 people in Racine by 2030. So it's a lot of jobs potential there as well. This whole business of knowledge workers is, do you know what is a knowledge worker?
Yeah, and at least for me, when I think about a knowledge worker, it's having specialized information that you can use to do your day-to-day job. So at least for me, for information security, I think of my job as being a knowledge worker. It may be needing to understand regulations, specific items within the information security industry and how to troubleshoot systems and what certain types of data look like and why they may look a certain way. So it's being able to use that data, synthesize it, and kind of communicate that out to people as well. So I might work with computers a lot of the times, but I also work with people like we all do. And sometimes it also requires being able to take that knowledge and translate it for people who may not understand it. So that's what it is for me, at least.
Yeah. When you think about benefits and drawbacks of AI, I suppose we could spend 4 hours talking about that. But
yeah. And I've used AI for analyzing data, which can be really, really helpful, especially when looking through large amounts of data that for a human, it would take days, months, years to read. So that can be really helpful. For me, I've actually used systems like ChatGPT, those large language models to brainstorm. So asking questions to get a little bit more information, maybe about a subject I don't know a lot about, or actually asking it about something I think I know a lot about just to see what information it gives me. So it can actually be a really good way for me to think about a different perspective. But I think that's one of the challenges people think about with AI as well as potential bias, primarily yeah. because, you get an answer and it feels very easy to trust. And I think with anything, it's trust but verify. So how can you get a little bit more understanding and even challenge some of the bias? And I think it's one of those items that as individuals, we know we have it, or at least hopefully we do know we have it. But when we train a lot of these models, we may train it on data that is not uniform. It's unbalanced in some way and helps to create bias. How can you train something in a way to limit the amount of bias, or at least being able to give maybe different perspectives on the same question to allow somebody to kind of critically think through that response? Because if we don't question it, I think that's probably the biggest challenge. I think we're going to be served very well if we are a little bit more curious about those answers and actually ask even more questions of where that information came from. If we wanted to take a completely different perspective on it, what would that look like?
So for the average person, what AI tools would you recommend just for day-to-day use?
For me, I use a variety of the large language models that are publicly out there. So ChatGPT from OpenAI is one of the big ones. A lot of the other models that are out there are based on ChatGPT, but you can find that there are ones through Meta or Google or other companies that you can find and use. For me, when I try to use just day-to-day asking random questions, I actually like to use a few of them because I'm curious in how the responses are different. Huh? And a lot of those large language models also have different settings. So one of the items I use through work is Copilot through Microsoft. And it's actually the ChatGPT, but you get a little bit more data protection through Microsoft. It has three different settings in terms of how you might want it answered, including, is it balanced? Is it more precise? Is it more creative? And so you might actually get different responses even within one tool. So depending on the question I'm really looking at, I might want to use different tools to get a better idea. But I tend to use it a lot for brainstorming. If there's just not something I can kind of think about, I might actually try to generate ideas of things for me to look at in more depth that, for whatever reason, if I have a mental roadblock, is hard to do. So that's one really nice thing about having a group of people in a room together and a lot of post-it notes. Yeah. Is you can generate a lot of ideas. But if you're by yourself and, may not have somebody to quickly talk to right away, a lot of those tools can actually be really handy just to to help start that generation process.
Yeah, stimulate the process. All right, we're talking technology today on the show. Started by talking about artificial intelligence. We're going to deal with cybersecurity. We're going to talk about WPR streaming and smart speakers with our guest today, Jesse LeGru. And you can join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Joe Patnod is our producer today. Jeff Robbins, our technical director. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR. Taking a look at technology on the program today, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jesse LeGru, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. He comes by pretty often to talk with us about technology issues. Cybersecurity is on a lot of people's minds. I know last week Microsoft announced that improving cybersecurity is the company's number one priority. How big a problem are cyber attacks? Pretty big.
They're pretty big. It's definitely getting a little bit more interesting every single day. So, when talking about security 20 years ago, I think many have been kind of in the field, even if it didn't have the name we think about it today, whether it's IT security, cybersecurity, information security. People have been doing it for quite a while, but especially if we've been seeing more reports of data breaches, systems being compromised, and they're not just a company that we know about far, far away. They're companies that are local to us. We see it in our school districts. We see it really in every industry in terms of some kind of issues going wrong. I think a month or two ago, I did have another letter in the mail about a different data breach with a different organization. It's definitely a little bit more mainstream. I think even with my insurance provider a few years ago, I think they actually included cyber insurance for on an individual basis. So if you actually had some kind of issue with a data breach. So it's definitely more mainstream for just standard individuals. And so it becomes, you know, more and more of an issue, not just with data security, but even impacting just day-to-day operations of a business. So some businesses close temporarily or even for permanently if they have some kind of cybersecurity incident.
Yeah, it's too bad. And I mean, we should be worried about this, I assume.
Yeah, I we should definitely be vigilant, and we should kind of think about what we can do to limit the impacts of really any kind of technology impacts. And usually in security, we think of three things. They call it the CIA triad, but confidentiality, integrity, and availability. Obviously, in the security, people mostly think about confidentiality, right? So I don't want anyone to have my data, so keep it confidential. But we're also concerned if that data has changed, if we can't trust the information that a system is giving us. So integrity is also important. But with most of our lives, especially using smartphones, even the technology that's helping with this broadcast, availability is really important. If things stop working, that impacts a lot of people's day-to-day lives. So we really have to think about all of those things in a variety of ways in our personal lives, but also in the work that we do on a day-to-day basis, because technology is hard to decouple from our lives. We just, at least for most of us, it's something that is constantly there.
Yeah. Anybody listening to this show should know. If you haven't heard it already, a week from today, WPR's Ideas Network will end. That's on May 20th. So WPR's, all of the 38 stations are going to shift to either being WPR News or WPR Music stations. listeners may need to reset their radios to continue to hear their favorite programs, or you can tune in through your computer, your mobile phone, or your smart speaker. Actually, more ways to listen to radio than there ever used to be, aren't there?
Yeah, and I've always used a variety of different apps, too, for streaming. And over the last year, it's been interesting moving from Stitcher and then the Google Podcasts and then to YouTube Music. So it always feels like there's something kind of changing, but it's nice to actually have that option to really get a content just about any time. And with the WPIR app, it's actually nice to see the different not only news articles that might open in the web page, but also to review some of the on-demand content as needed. So it's nice and easy to use. And a lot of the different smart speakers, and for anyone who's done a lot of, well, if people are used to actually using smart speakers and telling those smart speakers what to do, the process of actually getting it to work through WPR or anything else is relatively simple. Usually it's just, you know, helping to either enable, like for Alexa, you can enable WPR, but for a lot of the other ones, you can simply just say, you know, either listen to a specific channel, and usually WPR is going to be one of those three key letters to make sure that you give to your speaker, and it will be able to download any of the content either for specific episodes or for the, you know, news or
music
channels specifically.
Yeah, I've got the app, which was the updated app. If you haven't, if you're listening and have the old version of the app, you might want to update to the current app. But I come in the house and I just say, you know, Alexa, turn on WPR or Wisconsin Public Radio, I think I say, and boom, just like that, it's on.
Yep. Yeah, and I tend to listen to things when I'm driving a lot, and actually, when using the app too, it at least shows it in the background, so you can easily interact with the features of the car, which I do a lot when listening to podcasts or streaming other content, and so I can easily play and pause, and it kind of goes through the, in my case, the Android features, but works well with iPhones as well.
Yeah. In your mind, what are some good examples or some examples of good smart speakers out there?
There are so many options, actually. It used to be there was only Alexa, or at least it felt like there was only Alexa. There's actually a lot of those out there. I think Alexa is probably still one of the most common, but the Google Assistant is another one. And usually I note those two because most people either have an Android or they probably have an iPhone. There's a variety of individuals that might have other devices. But many people like those platforms just because it integrates with everything else that they have. And so a lot of the Google Home devices and the Amazon devices tend to be pretty popular, especially if you're already using those services, because it ties in kind of the rest of your life. It can usually access your calendar and all those great things. So most of the speakers themselves, they act as speakers, so I think they work really well. It just depends on whether you want it integrated with the other items of your life. So if I just wanted a speaker that I could listen to some streaming content, but maybe have a bit more decoupled from the rest of my life, I might also consider other products that are out there. Obviously, Apple has also their own items with Siri, so that's another great option. If you're using, you know, iOS devices, they tend to work very well together.
Jeff wonders, what's the difference between Amazon Alexa and Amazon Echo?
That's a good question. And usually, so Echo tends to be the device, which is usually the speaker. It might be the Echo or the Echo Dot. Alexa is actually the assistant that's kind of built in either to your device, which could be a Dot, or it could be an Echo Dot, or it could be any of the other different Amazon devices. So usually when you're saying Alexa, it's usually for a voice command for any of the Echo hardware series that you're getting through Amazon.
Gail in Madison emailed saying, concerned about smart speakers spying on them. Gail says smart speakers can hear what they say out loud in their kitchen and maybe see what they type and send on an email.
I think that's a fear that's going to probably be hard for anyone to truly not think about, especially since there is something that is sitting there listening. Really, it's listening for a prompt and otherwise isn't recording information. So as soon as you say a specific keyword, like in this case, Alexa, hopefully I didn't make anyone's speakers all of a sudden listen in. But once you do say that, it tends to be that prompt for it to listen and to record and then to respond. So that's really one of the reasons a lot of those speakers have those common names or commands, is to give it a prompt for when it should be listening, when it should be recording, and when it should be transmitting any information. So as long as those pieces are, you know, programmed correctly, and don't have a lot of what I'd call a false positive, so misunderstanding, and having it think you said Alexa even though you didn't, usually that information should be very safe. But I think that is something, as you know, as I buy any new technology in the house, I do think about, does it have a microphone, does it have a camera, what could it listen to, what could it record? Because I think those are still potential risks, not if they're, you know, if the devices are programmed correctly, it shouldn't be an issue, but maybe my Echo Dot is completely safe until there's malware on it. So
yeah,
if somebody is able to circumvent the device and install some kind of malicious program, you know, that becomes a risk. And a lot of these devices that we install, they're connected to the internet in some way, either so they could download content, but it also means if someone's able to scan that internal network or it's made publicly available on the internet, there could be additional risks. So it is something I think about. I think it's something as we purchase things, if we're not, I guess, willing to take that risk, maybe not buy it, but I think that's also challenges with some of our phones these days, because our phones are little computers with microphones, and they also have those assistants, and you can turn those assistants off, and you should be able to do similarly with a variety of different speakers, and you can actually control a lot of those through smartphones or other network utilities. But it is something I do think about. I'm usually not as worried due to how they make those systems work, but if those systems get compromised, it opens up other possibilities.
We had a note from an email from a listener who bought a smart speaker in anticipation of all the programming changes, and took their new smart speaker to their public library and received help setting it up.
Oh, nice.
So and that's something that could be done in probably any library in our state. if you having trouble getting it set up, we certainly provide some help, descriptor help on that as well. Gail was also wondering if the email to reach this talk program will change, and yes, that it will change. You'll just have to stay tuned, because I don't know what it is. So I have to stay tuned for the new email address, which will happen next week here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Just talking about Apple and and other devices. I know for a long time, Apple's made it easy to find a lost iPhone, a Mac, or an Apple Watch. Now, Android phones and tablets will be able to locate their devices through Google. How do these Find My technologies work anyway?
Yeah, a lot of them, and if you've ever taken a look at a network with a lot of different Apple or other devices, they tend to talk to each other. So, you know, most of the time when we think about like GPS, it's a device communicating with a satellite. Maybe it's communicating with a metropolitan wireless network, because those tend to be a little bit bigger and you can tie into locations. But let's say you don't have the internet or a satellite, how do you find a device? Well, one of the ways to do it is have other devices just around you also trying to look for other devices that are around you. And so it kind of creates this large network in which devices have an idea of what other devices are close to them. And for anyone who's used Bluetooth, whether it's a speaker or something else, if you go to this discovery mode, you'll see a list of all these devices that probably you have no idea what they are. Same thing if you're trying to stream it to a TV. It's very similar in which it's going to find other devices that are close to you. Those devices will know about you. You will know about them. And if you're able to collect a lot of that information, you can actually identify where something might be based upon only one device having a GPS signal. So I might have one phone that I know the location because I have GPS, but it might help give an idea of where 100 other devices are closer to it, because it's able to find close devices up to that one phone. And then those devices are also able to find other devices. So you can start trying to build a map in terms of where other items generally are. And that's usually how it works. So those devices are really helping to communicate with each other. And that data is sent to Apple. It's sent to Google or other providers that might need that information to help locate a device. Or with Apple, they also have those air tags. So instead of just having a device, you might be using kind of a location tool that might be attached to your luggage or attached in some other way.
There was another note here. The WPR mobile app allows listeners to hear programs on their own schedule. So for example, Chapter a Day, that will come on every day at noon, and you can choose to listen to it whenever you want to for the rest of the day on your mobile app. So that's kind of cool. Jacob in Madison is having some trouble listening to the WPR app. They didn't see a prompt for updating the app. And what I did was eliminate the WPR app and then get the app again. And the new app is what you go to when you go to the App Store. You're going to get the new app. So that only take a minute or two to do that. So that's what I did. But technical help, go to WPR.org. For the feedback at WPR.org, or you can even call, I think it's 844-266-7724, 844-266-7724. Questions, comments, maybe you've got a technical issue that you're dealing with your own phone or your own computer, questions of that nature. We'd certainly love to hear from you on those as well. And we can take those calls anytime. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller with Jesse LeGrew. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at technology on the show today, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jesse LeGrew, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. Great to have him back. And certainly if you have questions for him, and they could be, you know, maybe something connected to your own computer or maybe something connected to what we've been talking about the last 40 minutes or so, I hope you'll join in. Number's 800-642-1234 or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Sue in Baraboo will give you a chance. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Larry. It's Sue up in Baraboo, and I just wanted to comment on Alexa versus Hey Google. So the Alexa speaker versus the Echo or Echo Dot.
Sure.
And it's all about NPR because Alexa is much smarter. Alexa can find both the Ideas Network and the WPR News and Classical, but Google can't.
At least where you are, Sue. So your vote is for Alexa.
Well, I have both, but if I want to listen to Hey Google in my kitchen, then I have to plug in my phone, go to the WPR app, bring up the Ideas Network, and then click on the kitchen speaker, and I'm fine. But if I'm down in the lower level where Alexa is, I just say, Alexa, Ideas Network, and it comes up just like that.
Yeah, it does at my place, too. Thank you, Sue. Appreciate that call. Oh, man. Jesse, do you have a favorite GPS app? It's the topic of much discussion in Jeff's house.
You know, I really don't. I don't even think about it too much. So in terms of location, I usually use Google Maps for most things. I'm an Android user, so it just tends to be the tool that I use. Although I think Google Maps also works well on a variety of other devices. So I tend to use the GPS information that I'm usually getting through my carrier, and I use Google Maps to really do most of my day-to-day stuff. I've never actually looked into other options in the past. I think a long time ago I was using Yahoo Maps. That's not necessarily kind of getting at GPS information, but more so I use for directions. But no, it's mainly been my Google Maps.
I use Google Maps all of the time. I think I have other ones, but this one seems to be better at updating, or you know, if there's a problem, or if there's a maybe a little more remote area, it tends to be able to find that spot better than the other one. So I've just sort of haven't used anything else but Google Maps for a while now. Kathleen in Minneapolis, your turn. Hi, Kathleen.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Say, I have a iPhone SE, and it's a couple of years old, and it's developed a dead spot on the touchscreen that happens to be right where you would press to send a text.
Oh,
and
of course.
I don't send that many texts, so I don't think I've worn it out. But I'm curious if this is something that can be fixed. Like, can I fix it myself, or do I just need to get a new phone?
Yeah, you should be able to get it fixed, depending on the cost. So I normally would go just first to the Apple Store, but there might also be a variety of other local computer repair shops that will take a look at iPhones and can replace components. So usually if you do have an area on your touchscreen that isn't working, usually it's a new screen. The people that do this actually get really, really good at it, so they might be able to do it extremely quickly. I actually know someone who has an iPhone SE as well, and they actually just got a new battery replaced because it was just not working to the extent it was, and they were able to get in to an Apple store and actually get it replaced within 2 to 3 hours. They just had to drop it off for a little bit of time. That would be my first recommendation. Take a look at that. It's likely you probably don't need to get a new device. It is repairable. The question just is, how much will it cost? And if you look at Apple, you can also look at other local repair areas and get an idea if you wanted to compare costs.
Yeah. There you go, Kathleen. Good luck with that. Thank you for calling. Ron in Beulah, Michigan, your turn. Hi, Ron.
Hi. Thank you, guys. I bought a Mac Pro 13, I think it is, laptop for my daughter 2.5 years ago. She was taking an IT class. And the other day she turned it off and it wouldn't turn on in the morning. And she took it to the Apple store and they said the circuit board or logic board was bad and it would cost $600 to replace it. And we're not, it's not insured.
Mm.
So we're just wondering, what if we put that money into it and it's, you know, goes bad again? Did we just like crash the computer and try and get a cheaper laptop of some other company, or what do you think?
$600, that's a lot of money, Jesse.
Yeah, and so it's going to be a hard comparison. So one, I'd look, I'd probably try to see what other device, if you had to get a new one, how much would that cost? The benefit of getting a new device is usually you're going to have at least a 1-year warranty, if not 3, if you do get an extended warranty. So I think having that warranty period is going to be helpful if you do need any repairs for the new device in the future. You know, that being said, if it's going to cost you $1,500 for a new device and it's only $600 for the current device and it lasts for 2 years, which, you know, there's never a guarantee, but it could last longer. You might actually get a good benefit from what you're investing. The downside is it's hard to know. You just never know how long something's going to last. I've owned a variety of computers over the years. I've had some devices fail after 30 days. I've had some work completely without issue for 10 years. And it's hard to predict, you know, what is actually going to break and when it's going to break. I think one thing to note, if it is kind of a MacBook, most of the components that they have in those devices now are also, they're not interchangeable anymore. So like the hard drive, the memory, they kind of basically soldered on that logic board. And so when you replace it, it's basically like getting a brand new computer. Usually it wouldn't have the information on it. And I'm not sure, I haven't tried to look in a while to see how data can be taken off that existing device. But there are probably going to be some limitations with the repair. I think you can get a fine functioning device. The challenge is just not knowing how long it's going to last. And it could last for a very long time. But I would check on what is the warranty when that device is replaced. Usually, I think it's a 90-day warranty, but they might give you a little bit longer. If they gave you a warranty for at least a year, maybe it's worth the $600, because at least within that first year, you can get potentially a different replacement. But I'd probably look at the options and see what seems to make the most sense based upon the cost. Either way, there's, you know, a risk just because you kind of never know when things are going to break.
There you go, Ron. Thank you so much for calling. Jenny in Madison, your turn. Hi.
Hey, guys. You were talking earlier about using Google Maps when you're driving, and I've got a lot of miles under my belt, and I've found that using Google Maps is my preference over Waze, and Waze is W-A-Z-E, in the fact that it's instructions I feel come a little sooner, like if you need to take an exit, and the graphics are a little more clear, like you need to be in the right lane of the four lanes. But Waze, I do run in the background, so I'll open the Waze app and do not put in a destination, just let the app run. And Waze is very good. That's in letting you know that there's police ahead, that there's a hazard ahead, that there's construction coming up, and the two together just work really well.
Like that idea, Jenny. Jesse, what do you think?
Well, actually, I've never used Waze before, but I pulled it up and I'm looking at Madison. And I see a lot of little construction signs, which is not terribly surprising. but it actually seems like a nice addition. it also goes to note that some apps might be really good at one thing, but there's another benefit with having another app, and this is one of those examples. So that's a great suggestion.
Yeah, thanks, Jenny. Appreciate the call. You can join in, too. We'll get you on pretty quickly at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Mary emailed to ask how they can block junk email. They currently have a junk folder, but they don't want to even receive these unwanted emails. Mary said they somehow got on an email list for jobs. How do they just stop getting them altogether?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's not a good way to just kind of disconnect it from your email altogether. So you're going to receive it in some way. The best you can do is really make sure it either goes to the trash or to a junk folder. Actually, when Gmail started coming out, I actually recommended for a friend to sign me up for a bunch of stuff because I wanted to test their junk filters. Unfortunately, it was kind of a pretty poor choice on my part since I ended up using that email for a long time and I still use it. So I did receive a lot of junk, but I've actually seen over the years that those filters are getting better and better. And the best you can do is really help to train them. So if you do get something that's in your inbox that you want to make sure is generally not visible or you're not getting it, if you report it as junk, it will usually get filtered out and that information will be used for future emails you receive. So it will help to train it so that you don't get those pieces of email in your inbox. The only other thing I could recommend to try to limit anything also being received, you can go through your junk email to look for different unsubscribe options. Granted, some of those could be dangerous depending on where you're getting them from, because it could be phishing emails outside of junk. Otherwise, there are a variety of services you can actually, I think you can actually pay for it, which I generally don't like doing. To help you get unsubscribed from a variety of your email. If I really had to, I'd probably look in my junk email to get unsubscribe, but it's only unsubscribe from valid email sources, not necessarily those that have gathered your email from some other company and are just sending you junk for other reasons, or might even be sending you malicious emails. So one thing I might even think about, Google your email address and see what pops up, because that might give you an indication how your email might be supplied to other companies. The downside is it's hard to really limit that info. And usually the recommendation now is use one email for most of your personal communication and use one email to sign up for services. So this could be one of those items where maybe you want to generate a new email address for all your personal communications and make sure you tell your friends about it and keep that other email address just for subscribing to things that otherwise you just don't want to see.
Dan in Parker's Prairie, Minnesota, will go to you. Hi, Dan.
Hi, good morning. Hey, I wanted to promote Waze as a GPS system. We really enjoy it. And like the previous caller had mentioned, it gives you a lot of information about where the police are at or if there's an accident. But I've used Google Maps in the past, and I really dislike it. It's led us astray many times, taken us way out of the way to get somewhere. But my worst example was when we were looking for a restaurant in Des Moines. It took us down a dead-end street to a woods and wanted us to take the bike path that the neighborhood kids had cut through the woods to get to a swimming pool, which had no connection whatsoever to the restaurant.
Oh, boy. Dan, that does sound like bad. That does sound bad. Why would it be? Why would Google Maps be great in one spot and not so good in Parker's Prairie, Minnesota? No idea. I got no idea there, and it doesn't look like Jesse does either.
No, well, and it all depends on how a lot of the data is collected. Even with Google, you know, you tend to see, and usually this is for Street View, but there's a variety of ways they can get some of that data. either collecting it themselves or using other sources. One interesting thing is I was looking at ways since, you know, we've gotten a couple good suggestions about it. It does look like Waze was actually acquired by Google in 2013. It's interesting, even after, you know, 11 years or so, there is still a bit of difference between the two apps, because it did make me a bit curious. But it does depend on how they collect a lot of that data to travel from place to place. So it's very interesting.
Well, Dan, thank you again for calling. Appreciate your call. Gary in Pewaukee, we're going to get to you right after our news break. He has a strategy for getting rid of junk emails, and we'll be all ears for that one. But we need to take a look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on WPR, and then we'll be back with our guest, Jesse LeGru, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at technology on the show today, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jesse LeGru. Jesse, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. He helps establish and implement strategies to protect the privacy of institutional data and, of course, reduce institutional risk. Questions for him. Open lines get you on pretty quickly. Maybe there's something wrong with your phone or your computer. Maybe you've got a suggestion. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Jill, by the way, let me know that after May 20th, the email address that we'll be using instead of ideas@wpr.org, it'll be replaced by talk@wpr.org. So talk@wpr.org will be the new email address. In fact, it might already, I wouldn't try it, but I think wait till May 20th and you could try it then. You're going to get it. Gary in Pewaukee, has a strategy for us for getting rid of junk mail. Let's go there. Gary, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, I mean, like, so talking amongst my friends about junk email one time, first of all, you can't unsubscribe from a junk email because then you get five more because, you know, it's a good sender box. But what I found out that works on my laptop, I have Yahoo Mail, and I don't open it up, but I just right-click on it, and then a little box will come up, and it'll say, delete and block all future emails. And it seems to work.
Oh. So, right-click.
Yep.
And you get the block message, and you can, and it's worked for you.
Yep, it'll say something like erase, and then block all future emails.
Gary, thank you very much for calling. Jesse, it sounds like... Gary's got a good plan there.
Yeah, and there's similar items you can use in Microsoft email to block. It usually is something, it's still kind of hitting your email, but it's a user rule that you can create. So if for whatever reason you accidentally created a block and then you actually wanted those emails in the future, you should be able to remove it. But that's another great option.
Yeah, Fred's got something for us, too. Hi, Fred in Menominee.
Howdy. Well, I guess I missed. This is maybe a continuation of the previous call.
Okay, go ahead.
I turned the radio off because I'm talking on the phone. I've got two emails, Yahoo and Gmail. And in both of them, I can click on the three dots on the side, and you can choose to block senders. And I've been doing that, and it seems to take these things off, and I don't ever see them again. I'm wondering, is this okay?
Yeah. If you don't want to see them again, I think it'd be okay, right, Jesse?
Yep, it's totally a good option. And if for whatever reason you actually wanted to see those emails, because the one item with deleting is you don't see it. If you wanted to see them again, you can go back into that list of block senders. You can remove it, and new emails you'll receive. So it is an option you can turn on and off for specific senders.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling in. Joe in Wausau, we'll go to you. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Larry and Jesse. I like using Google Maps, and there was a time when it would talk to me through my radio and give me directions and stuff, and it no longer does that, but my radio does sync with my cell phone.
So one item I would take a look at, so when you are syncing it or you have it connected with a phone, there are some options with Google Maps you could try first. I would actually just try, if you try to play music on your phone, does it come through your stereo in your car? If it does, at least you know that connection should be working fine. One item I would take a look at on Google Maps the next time you're running it, they actually do have a mute button, which kind of overrides even the normal volume control you'd have on your vehicle. It could be that the app's muted when it's in that car mode. And that could be the reason that it's not speaking. There are some other settings where you can actually tune how much it does tell you when you're driving. So you can kind of customize it. It's a possibility some of those settings got changed, and that's the reason it's not vocalizing. For me, I think I actually had it telling me too many things that I didn't want to hear. And so I turned some pieces off, but you can always change those later. So when you do have it connected, one, just test with kind of a music player or anything else you might use to listen to audio. And then if that does seem to be working, I would actually, while connected to your TV, or not your TV, sorry, your car, whether it's a touch panel on your car or whether it's on your phone itself, usually it will have an option for settings, or you'll see a little volume control in one of the corners. Just see if any of those can be changed, because it might have been just a setting change in the Google Maps app.
Yeah, for sure. Jason in Cudahy, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Jason.
Hey, guys, how's it going? I had a question. So my father-in-law passed away a few years ago. He had a broken iPad, and we were trying to figure out a way to gain access to that broken iPad without knowing his password. He didn't like write down any of his passwords. My wife tried a bunch of different, what she thought were the right ones, and didn't come through. And I just wonder if there's anywhere we can send it to.
Yeah, that's a good question. So, I mean, my first recommendation would be to go to an Apple store to see if there's anything you do. I don't think there's anything they would be able to provide to get access to the device without having a passcode or any other information. Usually, the only other way to get access to a device would be through, if there was an iCloud account that could be logged into you. That could be another option to try to get access to the device. But if you don't have either of those pieces of information, it could be challenging. Now, granted, since iCloud is also managed by Apple, going to the Apple store might be a good idea, because they could have other options to grant you access.
Yeah.
And that can happen with a variety of other services where you actually may need a death certificate or other documentation, and they can potentially, with that information, offer some better options.
Yeah, that's that would be a good maybe the only way to do it is to go to one of their stores. Yeah, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too. Open lines get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Lynn in Pewaukee emailed to ask if Lynn needs to have an HD radio in order to listen to this show after on May 20th and after May 20th. Well, you can. You will be able to listen on an HD radio for sure. I think it's HD2. You know, you can also, as we were discussing earlier, you can get the WPR app and you can also just listen online at WPR.org. You know, you're going to be able to hear it online if you want to do it that way. But an HD radio definitely would work. But if you don't want to buy one, you got the app, you can listen online. Maybe if you have a smartphone or a smart speaker already, you should be able to hook it up so that you can listen through the smart speaker. So there's different ways to do it for sure. I'm just scrolling down here through my list of email notes. Kevin emailed to say, everything's getting more complicated these days. How do you, Jesse, deal with the frustration of people feeling that they have over technology that has become so specialized to and costly to support and repair? So,
yeah, and that's what's. I mean, that's a complication in just day to day life. In addition to just helping to support technology for any institution is. There tends to be a little bit more specialization, which means a lot more support. It can be a lot more time and money to do it. Usually I try to keep it to the basics, but there is always going to be some special application that needs a new tool that otherwise is hard to get. I think artificial intelligence is one of those where it's kind of it is a complicated field, but there are more interfaces to make it easier for just day-to-day end users that don't need to understand anything about machine learning or programming. For me as a person, I try to just, and this is probably a good thing for anyone, reevaluate what I'm doing with my devices because I might use my phone and my computer for a variety of things, but there's so much stuff that actually just goes unused over time. And a lot of my device and usage habits have changed. And so kind of doing your own inventory on the services that you use can be really helpful. Because maybe I don't need half a dozen streaming apps, even though I do actually have half a dozen streaming apps. There are ways to kind of simplify, one, to save some money, but also to simplify how many applications I need to install. Do you need a special kind of TV for some kind of device? But the same might go with any other technology that we're using, whether it's a smart speaker, a smartphone, a smart TV, everything's smart these days. Just think about what do you need? If you don't need anything fancy, maybe don't get the fancy thing, and it can keep things a little bit easier. But I think there's always going to be somebody that wants that. Which is the new technology because they enjoy playing with it or it offers some kind of benefit, including giving some of your time back. So, I would say sit down with a notepad. Yes, a notepad, maybe not, a computer with a keyboard and just write down the things you might need. And sometimes that self-inventory can actually be helpful to weed out some of those items you don't need.
Sharon emailed to say they have a family member who suffered a stroke and now can't change the channels on either radio or TV, but his voice is clear. So Sharon's considered getting him an Alexa so he could just speak to it and get what he wants to listen to. And she's wondering which smart speaker would be the easiest device for them to operate.
That's a good question. So I don't use a whole lot of smart speakers. But I did hear earlier that we did have a recommendation for Alexa. It sounded like some of the commands were just a little bit more intuitive than Google. So one thing I'd probably even try is you could probably even go to a store with a lot of the devices and actually try giving it commands and see how they respond if you get what you're looking for from it. But part of me would also consider, what kind of home is it? Do they normally use a lot of Apple products? Do they use a lot of Amazon products? Do they use a lot of Google products? If they use a lot of one particular thing, that might actually lead you to, well, they use a lot of Apple devices. They have an Apple TV. They have an iPhone. They have an iPad. Maybe getting one of the Apple smart speakers might be a good idea because it ties into everything. So I'd probably look at that in addition to try to go to a store and actually testing it out a little bit. But I think, you know, a variety of those items are going to work really, really well. But testing it out and actually really seeing what that behavior is like is important. For a TV, there also might be limitations there. So you need to make sure if you want it to work for changing the channels on a TV, what are the compatible tools that you can use for it. And some of those TVs also have a speaker built in that you might be able to use either through the remote or through the TV itself.
Yeah. Jeff and Madison called to share that recently they were using wayfinding tech in their car to find a motel at night in Indiana, and the software took them to a funeral home instead of the motel. And I don't imagine Jeff was planning on that long a stay. So there you go. Gary in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Gary.
Hello. Hello. I have a question about companies like Vanguard or Fidelity. I have some money with Vanguard. And, of course, I have a username and I have a password. And then they also send me a text with a code number that I have to use before I can get into my account. And then I can move money around at will. But I'm just wondering, I don't lose sleep over this, but I wonder once in a while, with the number of people around this globe who are very good at going where they don't belong, is there the potential for someone to get into a company, even as sophisticated as Vanguard, and do what they shouldn't be doing, and all of a sudden the money is gone?
Yeah, so I can at least speak to accessing the portal. So, for example, your access, you have, you know, a password and you have a phone number. Getting access directly to your account and your information. Text message tends to be a little bit less secure. One of the things we normally see through email phishing is they try to collect some of the data from end users so they can actually call your cell phone provider and actually do what's called a SIM swap. So they basically take over your phone number and they can get that authorization code. Usually that's how most people are going to kind of get in into a system like that. If you, when you log into your account, if you have the capability to move or withdraw funds, that's basically the same kind of access that anyone breaking into your account would have. If you, when you try to take an action, need some verification from another third party, that can actually be a really good protection. So first, you know, determine what you can do by yourself. If somebody gets access to your account, they can do the same thing. There's the other route some kind of bad actor might take, which is to actually try to compromise the company itself in a different way, whether it's through their technical staff, their customer service. It's always a possibility. And a variety of organizations do a lot of planning to make sure certain things need to take place for financial transactions to occur and are subject to a variety of regulations to help protect that information, not only through technical and administrative protections, but also through insurance and other avenues. So it's a possibility. It's always possible. The question is, how difficult is it? Likely they're going to try to break into your access rather than compromising the company, because compromising the company is more difficult, at least it should be. but either are possible options for anyone interested in trying to get those funds.
Gary, thank you for calling. And Jim in Pewaukee, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I have a comment about Waze and a question about email. On Waze, one of the things I really like about it, I drive all over the state for a rental car company delivering cars. And in addition to telling you when there may be police ahead, it can tell you if there's debris on the road. And if there's a traffic backup, it will automatically reroute you around it. Like the other day, I was coming back from Wausau to Madison, and there was a big traffic backup, and it took me off the interstate onto one of the roads that parallels it. Saved a whole bunch of time. That's what I have to say about Waze. On the email, is there any email apps or programs or services that will let me sort the email by sender?
Yeah, and I know I can't think of an email app, so I like Google Outlook or Microsoft Email. When you're in their email view, if you're just in your inbox, you can usually sort by date, subject, or name. If you're talking about filtering like different folders, any of them can do it. It just depends on whether you need to create rules in order for email to be moved from, let's say, your inbox into a subfolder. Google has something called tagging that you can also use to tag specific emails from different senders. So most of those email providers will have some kind of way to manage your email, whether it's by different senders or even by different content. But it's going to be a little different depending on the email provider.
Jim, there you go. Thank you so much. Barb in Madison, do you have a quick question for us?
Yes, I do. I have a television sitting above my computer screen in my office, and it turns on automatically in the middle of the night. Lately, I'm in an apartment. I don't know why it does that, but I make sure that I turn it to mute or at least down low volume before I turn it off.
Oh, my goodness me. So the TV turns it turns on willy-nilly in the middle of the night.
Several times the other night.
Any idea on that one, Jesse?
There could be a few. Some devices do have an automatic turn-on feature. I doubt it's that, but I would check the settings for the TV just in case. The other possibility that's pretty common, even in our household, is something will step on the controller or something and accidentally turn it on. So I'm sure that's been addressed, but it is something that does happen. The other thing that's possible is there's someone else relatively close to you that has another remote that happens to also work for your TV. There are ways to do it. There's not much you can do outside of maybe putting a switch to turn off the power.
Jesse, thank you so much. Jesse LeGrew, our guest, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. Always, he'll be back and we will do this again with him. And thank you for listening and stay with us. Lots in store on WPR. I'm Larry Mueller.